All right, I would welcome or welcome back everyone, members of the committee. And with that, I would like to call to order this edition of the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We are going to go ahead and start with the roll. Ms. Hansen, would you be so kind?
I'd love to. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Oh, our friend Representative Keel is excused today. Representative Liebling.
Present.
There's Rep. Hansen. Okay, thank you. Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Noor. Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto.
Pinto present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
And Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
Good morning. And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Thank you, sir.
And Hansen present.
Hi, yep, I got you. Thanks. So we have a quorum, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Wonderful, Ms. Hansen. Quorum being present, then we will move on to the next order of business, which is to approve the notes for 2/23/22. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bolden. I appreciate that. Are there any questions, corrections, or comments on the minutes before we go to approval? Hearing none, we will go ahead and do a voice vote. All those wish to approve, say aye.
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 Any nays? All right. The minutes for 2/23/22 are then approved. We will move on with the first order of on the agenda today. First up today, we have House File 3199, Representative Ryer's bill. Welcome back to the committee. I see that you do have an amendment. Would you like us to adopt it and get your bill in the shape you would like it?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, wonderful. Then we will go ahead and move the A1 amendment and we'll do a quick voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, and the ayes have it. With that, we have gone ahead and approved the A1 amendment. The next motion would be to move the House File 3199 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus. Representative Ryer, would you like to explain your bill as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's a pleasure to be back here with you today. I'm here to talk about House File 3199. It's a bill that addresses disability caregiving workforce shortages by raising the weekly hourly cap currently in place for family members who provide care for their loved ones with disabilities. The legislation would not increase assessed hours of services for Minnesotans with disabilities. It would simply allow family members to be reimbursed for providing more of these assessed hours of care. This helps alleviate the shortage of workers and the economic hardship these families face in their efforts to support their loved ones at home rather than congregate settings. This is a lower cost and creative way to help fill the critical void existing today in our disability caregiving workforce. Specifically, the bill would raise the current 40-hour weekly cap in place for parents of minors and spouses by allowing each parent in a two-parent household to provide up to 40 hours of caregiving per week. It allows a single parent or a one parent in a household where only one of the two parents can provide care to provide up to 60 hours of caregiving per week. And it allows spouses to provide up to 60 hours of caregiving a week. This bill provides needed flexibility and better support for families with medically fragile children or spouses to care for their loved ones with a disability at home. And it allows them to better control who comes in and out of their house as we continue to navigate the COVID pandemic. The Senate bill is authored by Senator Abler and was heard last week in the Senate Human Services Committee hearing focused on workforce solutions. I'm hopeful for the bill's path in the Senate. I would also like to thank my bipartisan second author, Representative Schumacher, as well as my other colleagues who have signed on to this bill. I will now turn to my testifier, Sarah Kasner, to share her personal story, and we'll look forward to any questions you may have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Schultz, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Sarah Kasner. We are a family of six, including my husband, Dan, and four boys with initials A, B, C, and D. AJ, Ben, Caleb, and Duncan, who only goes by Dunky. We have not one, but two boys that suffer from a rare genetic progressive and terminal disease called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. For those not familiar with Duchenne, it exists because kids lack an essential protein called dystrophin that helps muscles get stronger. Every single movement that Caleb 8 and Dunkey 6 make makes them weaker as the muscle is replaced with fatty tissue. This eventually ends with the lungs and the heart. Life expectancy is generally late teens or early 20s, but far too often I read about kids dying much younger from Duchenne. Our kids cannot do what typical 6 and 8-year-olds do. They need help with simple daily tasks most take for granted. Things such as brushing your teeth, putting your jacket on, toileting, getting out of bed, putting night splints on, getting in the car, it goes on and on. This disease also comes with social issues such as anxiety, autism, ADHD, and depression. Additionally, this disease requires daily steroids, which cause serious behavior issues and weight gain. And guess who helps them? We do, because we are their parents. We help them because it means more time with them, and we do not know how much time on earth we will get with them. So yes, it does mean I would rather help my kids with toileting than not, if it just means one more minute with them. We help them because we are also not guaranteed tomorrow. I am a carrier of Duchenne. Caleb was diagnosed 4 years ago. When he was diagnosed, the neurologist asked if he could see his brother. After directing him to the lobby, it took just a touch to the calf, and 5 seconds of watching him play for us to find out this disease also affected not only our then 4-year-old, but also his little brother. As a carrier, I am now followed by a cardiologist as I'm in heightened risk for fibrosis of the heart. As if it wasn't enough, my kids have this disease. It could mean that I also may not always be here to help them. My husband stays home to be the main care provider, and I work full-time in a demanding job, while of course also helping with the boys, but I am exhausted all the time. I wake up well before the sun to help one kid go potty after taking turns to help kids with various requests during the night. We tag team to get the kids ready for school. Once we get them off, I quickly get ready for work all day and try to manage my schedule so I can help them after school or bring them to therapy or doctor's appointments. And at night we have a routine. It takes both of us and starts immediately after dinner. And then I pull out the computer and I work. I work until I'm too tired to work anymore or to make up for the time that I chose to spend with my kids. But what if it were different? What if this bill passes and I could dial back at my regular job so that I could provide personal assistance services to my children under CDCS? What if it meant that I could live a more desired lifestyle for my kids and for my family? Currently, there is a 40-hour household cap for CDCS, which means that no more than 40 hours can be paid to one or both parents, regardless of the number of parents available to provide the care or the number of children receiving the services. Lifting this 40-hour household cap will make a difference because I have not just one, but two little boys with failing bodies that would have their mommy by their side in day in and day out if they had their choice. I also have two kiddos that have very high needs that are unique to each of them. I thank you for the opportunity to share my story and for the willingness to understand the positive impact this would have on families like mine. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kastner. Really appreciate your courage to come and speak before the committee today. And I can tell you, as someone who has had similar situations in our own family, I understand the sheer passion and the energy that it takes to care for a loved one with disabilities. So thank you for your courage to come and speak with us today. I understand we do all.
You're muted, Madam Chair.
You're still muted, Vice Chair Bonner.
I'm getting the signal. We do have a Ms. Garrett's also available for questions, if there are any. Do we have any questions from the members for the testifier or for Representative Ryer? All right. I'm going once. No questions and comments. Well, Representative Ryer, it appears that you have done a bang up job getting folks excited about this bill. With that, I am going to go ahead, hearing no further comments. I'm going to renew my motion to lay over House File 3199 as amended for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus. All right. And with that, we will move on to the next bill. For next up, we have House File 2721, Representative Lippert. Welcome back to the committee. The motion is to lay over 2721 for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Omnibus as well. Representative Lippert, I do not see any amendments, so we'll move that before the committee. Would you like to go ahead and speak to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Last session, I presented a rate framework reform proposal for PCAs that would use workforce and Minnesota market data to determine the actual cost of providing PCA services, and then provide the legislature a statutory framework that would build those costs into the system over time. The data would be evaluated every 2 years so that the PCA program is responsive to the Minnesota economy to maximize our resources so that we can ensure that the 44,000 older adults and people with disabilities in Minnesota who rely on PCA services can live safely in their homes and stay engaged in their community. That bill passed out of this committee last session with strong support. The core of the rate framework proposal was also passed into law as part of last session's Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill, along with a vital rate increase that went into effect October 1st of 2021. The PCA program was on the verge of collapse, and the rate increase was a lifeline. Because the need for immediate support for the PCA program was so great, the legislature left behind parts of the rate framework that built sustainability into the PCA reimbursement over time. This bill, House File 2721, brings those key components back. The missing pieces this bill fills in are, one, rebasing the Bureau of Labor Statistics data used to establish the rate each biennium to reflect the wages paid for direct support services like PCA in Minnesota. Two, reviewing the competitive workforce factor every 2 years to determine the impact of the broader economy on wages in similarly situated professions. Three, build in increases to the implementation factor in recognition that the current framework only reimburses PCA providers 75.45% of the cost of providing PCA services. And four, indexing the client programming and supports factor to inflation to recognize the impact the broader economy has on providing PCA services. The primary obstacle to the recruitment and retention of PCAs is low wages. The primary obstacle faced by people with disabilities and older adults as they seek to get the care they need now in their homes and in the years ahead is low wages paid to those who provide care. House File 2721 makes sure our new rate framework addresses this. With me to testify today is Pang Vang. And I'll turn it over to her.
Hello.
Ms. Vang, if you'd like to go ahead and state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pang Vang. I am the treasurer for the Minnesota First Provider Alliance, a statewide membership association for the personal care assistant providers. I run a minority-owned PCA agency, Rainbow Healthcare, located in the Twin Cities for the past 19 years. For several years, the Provider Alliance has advocated for increased wages for PCAs to establish best practices and higher integrity standards in our industry. The Provider Alliance believes strongly that the PCA program is one of the most cost-effective service delivery models for individuals with disabilities and older Minnesotans, and likely saves the state tens of millions of dollars a year by keeping individuals in their own home and out of higher cost care settings. 44,000 people with disabilities and older adults rely on PCA services to live, work, and participate in their communities. Most are facing a severe shortage of workers to provide these essential services. The difficulty in finding and retaining PCA workers puts people who rely on these services at risk of neglect and hospitalization. We need to further fund the PCA rate framework passed into law last session and include language that would build cost-based adjustments into the reimbursement rate over time. When we developed the PCA rate framework, we utilized the individual home support, or IHS, without training framework as a model, because this service is similar to PCA. The current metro rate for IHS without training is $33.96 an hour. The current PCA hourly reimbursement rate is just $19.60. We are not saying the rate for IHS is too high. We are simply pointing out that the rate for PCA is too low and continues to be underfunded. A continued investment in the PCA program is essential to support the efforts of providers and individuals receiving services to recruit and retain PCA workers by paying them a livable wage. The Provider Alliance believes that House File 2721 is essential to ensuring the long-term viability of the PCA program, and we appreciate your support today. I would like to introduce Greg Stoltz, who will be testifying after me and will be sharing his family story.
Thing. And we have a Mr. Stoltz with us today.
Hello, this is Greg.
All right, Mr. Stoltz, if you want to go ahead and state your name, affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair of Committee. My name is Greg Stoltz. I appreciate the opportunity to share my family story regarding PCA services. My wife and I both, being raised in Grand Rapids area, loving the laid-back and friendly surroundings, we chose to continue to raise our family here. Our only child, Samantha, was diagnosed with a terminal illness, Friedreich's ataxia, at the age of 11 and wasn't supposed to live past 20. Thankfully, research and treatment of this horrible disease has increased the life expectancy for those with it, and our daughter Samantha will soon be 34. We love and cherish every moment we have with her, except for the wheelchair and the noticeable health issues. Samantha is just like any other young lady her age. She loves to shop, spend time with her friends, family, and especially her dogs. She volunteers weekly at a nonprofit organization in the area to help keep her mind active and her fine motor skills working. It's very important that adults like Samantha remain in their homes with their family for as long as they can. They need loved ones around them at times like this. As time passes, Samantha's disease continues to progress, and she needs more and more care. She currently receives 24/7 PCA services in our home. PCA staff has always been difficult to find and even more difficult to keep on a long-term basis. And in the past, we could keep people a year, maybe two, before the search for someone else had to begin, but not anymore. Now, not only has COVID affected businesses in our area for retaining or hiring new volunteers and workers, but with minimum wages being in the $15 to $16 area, nursing homes and other assisted care facilities paying even more than that, as well as offering sign-on bonuses, 401ks, and even offering to pay for schooling, has become next to impossible for not only for us to find PCA staff, but also keep them. We are losing the best workers we currently have with no hopes of finding new ones. Samantha received state MA for her health care. Because of this, the pay that PCAs make is limited to what is paid to the agencies that hire the PCAs. And with the reimbursement rate of only $19.60 an hour, our agency can't afford to pay the workers any more money or allow them to work any overtime. Allowing an overtime rate would allow us to maximize the few great PCAs that we have left. We are hoping and actually begging that the rate for the PCA services be increased so that the PCAs can earn a livable wage. PCAs are paid to take care of our elderly and our disabled. We feel that they are doing an important job that can sometimes be undesirable with the duties that they have to perform, and we believe they deserve a decent wage. If we don't do something soon, there will be many folks not getting the care they need. What then? Currently, my wife and I both work full-time jobs to help support not only our daily needs, but also those needs of Samantha, that are not covered under any service. Sometimes we even pay the PCAs out of our pocket. We want to keep Samantha living in our house in a safe environment when we cannot be there. So please help us help those that can't help themselves. Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me share the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz. And again, I want to thank you for your love and devotion to your loved one. Certainly, I'm glad to hear the prognosis for Samantha has gotten better. I know in my family as well, my family member was expected to live to about 20 and lived well into his 50s, nearly 60 years old. And I believe firmly that was because of that incredible love from the family. So thank you for being here today to speak speak with us. All right. Do we have any member questions or comments? Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Stoltz and the other testifier, and thank you, Representative Lippert, for bringing this bill. We know that this bill hits so many sweet spots right now, right? We have one of the things we've been talking about a lot in this committee is workforce. And we have many people with disabilities who can and should be part of the workforce if they get the appropriate support to do that. Many people like Mr. Stoltz's daughter. And this is incredibly important. The reason that I just wanted to have a moment here is to say that in our last HHS omnibus bill, as Representative Lippert mentioned, that we put in the new PCA framework, we did do an increase. And this was a start to something that many members have said over the years that we should be doing. This is just incredibly important and had been left behind for a long time because it is expensive. It is expensive to provide care that needs to be provided. And I always say, I think most Minnesotans are proud that we do this and want us to do it well. I would just say that every GOP member of the House voted against our HHS omnibus bill last time. And I'm hoping that this is an issue that you will care enough about that you will, if we get this into an HHS bill, if we have the funds to do that, that you will provide your support to it, because that would go a long way to making sure that it can actually happen this year. So I hope that the GOP members will really think hard about this, because this is incredibly important stuff, and I think we should all get behind it regardless of party. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, for that context. Do we have any additional members with questions or comments for either Representative Lippert or for the testifiers? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Bonner. And I just want to add to that. We have a lot of group homes closing across the state because they can't find staff members to staff those group homes. And therefore, we're going to rely even more on individual PCAs. And so making sure that they get the market wage and benefits that they deserve for the work that they, the very important work that they do, is really vital right now. So we have to do what we can to keep those group homes open, but also to increase the number of PCAs that we have in Minnesota. And that's also important to support the previous bill, Representative Ryer's bill, to allow family members to care for their loved ones and increase the hours. So it is really vital that we get these bills through the process and provide options for family members and higher wages for PCA. So I just want to thank the bill authors, Representative Ryer and Representative Lippert, for bringing these bills forward.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. It looks like Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel compelled to respond to the remarks that Representative Liebling made in response to motives about the votes that were taken last session, principally with regard to the health omnibus bill. It's a bit disappointing that the assertion by one against an entire caucus with regard to our unfamiliarity with the numerous other provisions in that bill that were highly objectionable to my caucus drove many, in fact, as it was noted, everyone to vote against that omnibus bill. But make no mistake, the assertion that we are not in favor of those that are most vulnerable, that live in the shadows of our society, is a bit disappointing. And I rise to a point of order on that one. And I hope that she would think twice before raising that point again. If this bill is so important, why not bring it forward as a standalone bill rather than lay it over? Because we all know why you're doing this. It's as transparent as paint. So let's be honest about the purpose and the intentions of bills and what omnibus bills actually call into question. Let's be honest with ourselves and a little bit more authentic about the comments that we make. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. You know, I think certainly we understand that, you know, we are in an unprecedented time and looking for unique solutions and ways to really give more options to families on how to care for the loved ones to ensure that we get the best quality of care. And I guess I interpreted those comments a little bit differently in that I think the message here is that regardless of our viewpoints, that I think these are all issues that we can come together on and really support families and options to get their loved ones the absolute best care that we can. Do we have any additional questions or comments before we go to the author for final comments? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, what is the motion? Is it to lay this bill over? So I stand correct on what I'm about to do?
It is to lay the bill over, yes.
Madam, I would make a motion that rather than lay this bill over, that we move to re-refer this bill to Ways and Means. And I would ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would ask, do we have a fiscal note on this bill? Because I'm not aware that we do. And usually our practice is to keep bills in committee until we at least know their cost. So I see Mr. Berg has come on camera. Maybe he can tell us, because this is likely to be rather expensive. And I think that as Representative Albright knows, I understand his sensitivity, having voted no on our bill and having recommended to all his members that they vote no. But I don't think, you know, he basically questioned my motives. And now he's making a very political motion to try to redeem that no vote from last session. But anyway, I don't think there's a fiscal note on the bill. So, it would be nice to hear what Mr. Berg has to say about that.
Mr. Berg, are you available to speak to the financial aspects of that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling and members, there is a pending fiscal note request that is not completed and certainly can't be completed until at least after the February forecast is released on Monday, I believe.
Very good. And I guess I will ask staff for a recommendation on how to proceed here. It seems clear that we perhaps still have some additional work to do in this committee to review the financial aspects of this bill before we were to send it on. But I know that a motion was requested. Representative Albright, would you consider retracting that motion for now so that we can take this up later and discuss the financial aspects of the bill?
Madam Chair, I am aware of a number of instances where a bill has been re-referred out of committee without the fiscal note being attached by virtue of the rationale that it will catch up with the bill in a later finance committee or ways and means. So I will not retract that request.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I think that we could certainly refer the bill to Ways and Means. There's no problem really doing that other than that it's a little bit meaningless. Of course, Chair Schultz can still put the bill in her omnibus. Honestly, I'd be really happy to see us pass this bill off the floor if we wouldn't have members playing games with the money and keeping the money in the bill, whatever it is. We do have a big budget surplus, and you know that would certainly not be something that DFL members would oppose. But I think it's just a political move today. But if Representative Albright wants to do it, I would just recommend that members vote yes on it. But of course, it is Representative Lippert's bill, and you'll probably want to hear from him as well as Chair Schultz on that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Then why don't we go ahead and hear from Representative Lippert on your desire, perhaps with this bill, if you wish to keep it in committee at this time, or if you'd like to go ahead and move it on. I just want to get your perspective on that before we actually proceed with a motion.
So I thank you, Madam Chair. I would defer to Chair Schultz on this question. I'd be curious to hear her perspective on it.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Well, we just really need to not be political here. This is an important issue, and we also have to be mindful of all the other competing important issues. So my preference is to keep it in this committee until we hear a fiscal note. But if we can get assurance that Republicans will support it, if it goes to the floor, we can try that method as well. So I think, well, if Representative Albright can give us assurance that he can get the Republicans to support this and not amend it on the floor, and once we see the fiscal note, I guess we can also have this discussion in Ways and Means. So, members, I'm comfortable voting it to Ways, but you feel free to vote how you would like. Representative Albright, what are your thoughts on support and no amendments on the floor?
Madam Chair, this bill should travel by itself. If you want to hold it in committee and wait for the fiscal note, but not include it as part of an omnibus bill, that's a stopgap measure. I would be open to that, but I would wish that this bill would not be laid over, that it would be held for further consideration pending the fiscal note. But as some have asserted, this is not a political move. This is a point of authenticity for both caucuses to represent themselves from a perspective of what truly is their value system. So I make no promises about the membership of my caucus other than a recommendation that I might make for myself based upon my own value system. But we have certainly always been in support of PCAs in the past. So I'll leave it up to you to decide how you want to make the re-referral on this one. But I do stand on the point that I would appreciate a vote to take it to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Chair Schultz, do you have any additional comments?
Thank you, Chair Bonner. I think we should probably look at the fiscal note in this committee. So I think laying it over is fine since we're going to bring it back to evaluate the fiscal note. I think members of this committee would like that ability since many don't serve on Ways and Means. So I would say let's take a voice vote. I'm going to be voting no. So Ms. Hansen, or we don't need to take a roll. All those in favor, or Chair Bonner, why don't you take a vote right now?
Madam Chair, I did request a roll call vote.
All right, thank you, Representative
Madam Chair, this is Representative Pinto. May I ask a question?
Yes, please. Representative Pinto.
My question, I just wanted to get clarification for Representative Albright. I thought I heard him say that he would specifically not want this proposal to be included in a budget, a broader budget proposal from this committee. I just want to make sure I understood that before voting. If that is his desire, that in fact, if this committee is advancing a package of proposals that we're saying is important to us, but he would not want this to be included in that. If we could just clarify that.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, the motion is to have it referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you. A roll call being requested. There is a motion on the floor to refer this to the Ways and Means Committee. I will ask Ms. Hansen if she will be willing to take the roll.
Sure. Chair Schultz?
No.
Vice Chair Bonner?
No.
Lead Albright?
Aye.
Aye. Albright, aye. Oops, sorry, I'm nervous all of a sudden. Schultz, no. Vice Chair Bonner, no. Lead Albright, aye. Rep Bolden?
Bolden, no.
Bolden, no. Representative Burkle?
Burkle, aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, no.
Fisher, no. Representative Frederick?
No.
Frederick, no. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, no.
Hansen, no. Keel, excuse. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Aye. Representative Moeller?
No.
Moeller, no. Liebling, aye. Moeller, no. Representative Moore?
Aye.
Aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Thank you. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, no.
Pinto, no. Representative Rasmussen? I'll circle back. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Robbins, aye. Representative Sandel is in another committee right now, excused. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. 1 second.
Liebling changes from aye to no.
Oh, thank you, Rep. Liebling. Nine no's, seven yeses, two excused.
All right, and with that, the motion does not succeed.
I'm sorry, three excused. I did not count a vote from Representative Rasmussen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hansen. It went that the motion to re-refer to Ways and Means does not succeed. So then we will then go ahead and revert to the original. And I believe we were just about to hear from our author before we went to go ahead and consider this, laying this over for possible inclusion. And no doubt, I am certain that we will be revisiting this topic once a fiscal note is available to continue this conversation. To the author, would you like to have some final comments?
Thank you, Chair Bonner. I appreciate this conversation and also appreciate the care and concern expressed for people with disabilities in Minnesota and older adults in Minnesota and PCAs and making sure that they receive fair wages. And I hope that bodes well for fully funding this rate framework and finishing the job on this rate framework this session. So thank you for the conversation and consideration of this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. Certainly, it seems that this is a topic of great concern. So with that, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 2721 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Bill. All right, members, we'll move on from there. We do have another bill up yet here. We have House File 3471, Representative Moeller. I see that you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the amendment to House File 3471 with the A1 amendment?
I would, Madam Chair, and first just to move the bill before the committee, I believe the intent is to lay this bill over. And then I would also move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. So moved, I will move the A1 amendment, and I will recommend that we bring House File 3471 as amended before the committee with the recommendation to lay that over for possible inclusion. Representative Moeller, now that we have the bill in the shape you would like it, if you'd like to speak to the bill as amended.
We need to vote on the amendment.
Oh, my apologies. Thank you, Chair Schultz. Let's go ahead and vote on the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Thank you. All right. Sorry, I got a little ahead of myself there, Representative Moeller. But certainly, we have, in fact, the vote does succeed. We will recommend your bill as amended to bring it before the committee. And with that, I will let you go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is the DHS policy bill. And just so you're aware, there is a mini clone of this bill that is in the Judiciary Committee. So we don't have to handle those provisions. We can do those in the Judiciary Committee. This bill includes technical corrections and clarifications related to DHS disability, behavioral health, and housing programs. It also includes some policy changes related to home and community-based critical incident reviews, ABLE account establishment, and early intensive developmental intervention. DHS staff have vetted these provisions with stakeholders, including advocates and providers over the past year. And Christy Grom from DHS is here today to provide an overview of the changes and help answer questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. And I believe we do have Ms. Grom here to speak. Ms. Grom, if you'd like to go ahead and proceed and state your name for the record. And proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. Wanted to start by giving thanks to Representative Moeller for carrying this bill and really championing our issues over the years, and also just thank the committee for spending some time and listening to this bill. So I'll walk through, well, first of all, there's a handout that should be posted online in your virtual packets, and I'll walk through kind of using that handout through each of the major provisions in the bill, and then hopefully we'll have some time for discussion following that. So the first major bucket item in our bill this year is related to just technical corrections and obsolete provisions. So Section 9 repeals a foster care moratorium exception. That was an exception that was created by the 2017 legislature. It has sunsetted in 2018, and so we're just removing that from the books, cleaning things up. Section 10 clarifies something related to our integrated community supports service. So right now, one of the licensing requirements for this particular service is that each setting where the services are delivered needs to submit a settings capacity report. This is part of our compliance with the federal home and community-based services rules. But current law only requires providers to submit the number of individual living units in which those services are delivered. And so this change just clarifies that providers need to also submit the total number of people who receive those services so that we're able to monitor the capacity requirements appropriately. This is currently already a regulation in place, so we're just aligning law with practice. And then we have a provision removing an incomplete and kind of unnecessary provision in the intensive rehabilitative mental health services statute. This was a reviser's recommendation that was flagged for us, which we appreciate. So clarifying that and making that correction. In sections 26 and 27, we are correcting eligibility for long-term homeless supportive services grant. So this is a grant that goes to counties and tribes and some other collaboratives, but there are places in the statute where we don't mention tribes in terms of eligibility. So we're just clarifying throughout statute that tribes are also eligible for these funds. And then section 31 is a reviser instruction update. This is changing terminology from chemical dependency to substance use disorder, just aligning it with literature in the most recent version of the DSM. And then section 32 in this particular bucket of technical proposals is a repealer. So we're repealing the Citizens Advisory Council. This is a council that's no longer in existence. There's been a few other councils that have popped up throughout the years, and those are still in existence. We're still getting stakeholder feedback through those venues, but this one is no longer needed. And then we're also repealing the Substance Use Disorder Continuum of Care pilot project, which is a pilot project that was passed into law in 2013. As a way to help providers implement direct access or substance use disorder direct access prior to full statewide implementation of that reform. And we're about ready to make that reform fully this July and July 1st of 2022. And we don't have any of those pilot projects in existence anymore, and there's not a need for this, so we are repealing it. Another kind of group of technical changes related to telehealth. Beginning in section 21. So this is a change related to long-term care consultation reassessments. Last session, the legislature authorized the permanent continuation of remote reassessments under certain circumstances for our disability waivers. And specifically, the legislation allowed for those reassessments to occur under three specific situations: that there is no change in the person's condition, there's no change in a need for service, and that the remote reassessment is appropriate. And I think what happened was just those provisions were written kind of hastily, and we just needed to make some clarification. So we've worked with our lead agencies over the interim to make sure that we were able to write that in a clearer way that facilitates people's access to those reassessments when they are warranted and when they want them. And then also in the telehealth clarifications bucket, sections 18 and 31 have some changes. So section 18 clarifies that audio only can be used to meet the face-to-face requirements for the encounter rate for certain settings, including our certified community behavioral health clinics, beginning July 1st of 2021 and then ending July 2023 or the end of the COVID public health emergency, whichever is later. And then section 30 just clarifies that audio only modalities can be used to meet the face-to-face requirements for case management, targeted case management. So these were changes that were approved by the 2021 legislature. We received some feedback from stakeholders that they would like some clarification just to make sure that that the expectations were clear in law for them. And so we've worked with stakeholders on this language as well as our HHS legislative chairs to make sure that we're aligning with legislative intent. The next big bucket of proposals really comprises the bulk of this bill. It's related to our mental health uniform service standards. So these are in changes in sections 1 through 8, 11 through 15, 17, 20, 22 to 23, and 28. So I believe close to 20 sections out of 32 of the bill. So this is most of what the bill is. So as a reminder, the first phase of mental health uniform service standards passed last session, and this was a proposal that helped to align our mental health provider standards to reduce administrative burdens and to make sure that our standards really focused on equitable delivery of services. And then ultimately, it's establishing a unified licensing framework for mental health services. So this was a huge initiative. Many of you might remember it from last session. It was, I think, over 200 pages. And as a result, there's just some cleanup that's necessary. The bulk of the changes in this section are updating cross-references. There were a couple of clarifications that we missed last session, so we're updating those clarifications that stakeholders have agreed to in this language as well. And then we're making some sort of conforming changes. The USS bill passed in regular session in the HHS minibus, and then there were changes made in the same areas of statute in the HHS omnibus bill, so in special session. So we just have to reconcile, we just needed to reconcile some of those changes here. The next proposal I will provide an overview of is our culture of safety proposals. So DHS is required by state and federal law to track critical incidents, things like maltreatment of adults and minors, serious injuries, use of restrictive procedures that occur in our programs that we license and that we fund. And the typical model for conducting those investigations really focuses on determining whether maltreatment occurred, and if so, who was responsible, who was at fault, really sort of relying on a punitive approach for those critical incidents. As a result of those kinds of actions, oftentimes staff or a program in whole is removed from the system, and that is probably necessary in some cases, particularly when it comes to abuse or exploitation. But we do know that evidence shows that agencies that use a reactionary approach are actually less safe because we're not accounting for how the system is operating and what the systemic improvements are that would be needed to deter these critical incidents from happening in the future. So in 2018, DHS formed a steering committee and developed a pilot for critical incident reviews for the home and community-based services system. So this type of review, our culture of safety pilot, does not replace licensing actions or maltreatment actions. The steering committee is comprised of providers, lead agencies. We have Hennepin County, St. Louis County, Blue Earth, Dakota, Homestead, Clay, Polk, and Ottertail right now. And then a whole host of DHS representatives also are included in that. And that group of folks reviews critical incidents that occur in 245D licensed settings. So they look at things like medication error, wheelchair safety, service terminations, COVID-19 related incidents. And so the language at hand really just establishes this pilot as a permanent critical incident review in law. And then as Representative Mahler pointed out, there are some important data privacy protections in this particular area of law, as well as some protections for participants who participate in those critical incident reviews so that they have some assurances and can feel open and honest when they're working through some of those critical incidents. And those particular parts of the proposal will be discussed in Judiciary Committee. And we have some changes in our early intensive developmental behavioral intervention area of law. So we're updating some definitions, mostly in reaction to things that happened in previous sessions, changes that were made, and have a couple of terminology changes. And then sort of the most substantive part of the changes in this area of law, which is in, for members, sorry, I didn't orient you with sections 24 and 25, is changing some requirements around our coordinated care conferences. So qualified supervising professionals are sort of the higher level of EIDBI professionals that oversee other professionals. And right now they are mandatory participants in the coordinated care conferences. And what we found is that because those professionals, there's a workforce shortage and those professionals have higher levels of expertise, it is difficult to find them sometimes, and the coordinated care conferences have been delayed as a result. And so that's not something that we want. So this would make their attendance at those conferences optional. They will still be required to oversee any changes that are made to the treatment plan and sign off on all of those changes. And then the final bucket of changes in our bill is related to our ABLE account. So the Minnesota ABLE account, it's Achieving a Better Life Experience, is a tax advantage savings account that allows folks with disabilities to build their savings without risking losing their benefits like medical assistance and disability waiver programs. So a really critical program for people with disabilities, we know are by and large living in poverty. Since last summer, I believe we've been able to help people save more than $12 million in assets through these accounts. So they're an important function and serve an important function for people with disabilities, and we want to make sure that they're preserved and well managed. So since the federal passage of the particular act that authorized these accounts, the IRS has been working on finalizing rules around the accounts. And so this particular proposal just codifies and mirrors what the IRS rules are related to account creation. So it just specifies that when an individual is unable to specify their own ABLE account, that there are others that could establish that account on their behalf. One of the reasons that this proposal is really important is because we have heard, well, we've heard from stakeholders that they really want this change. And one of the unintended consequences of not making this change and just relying on the federal rules is that people think that they can't have someone else establish these accounts. And so we've seen folks seek out conservators for the sole purpose of establishing an account. And we certainly want to make sure that people use conservatorship and guardianship as a last resort option. And so this would allow, you know, a guardian or a spouse or a parent or someone to set up that account for a person. So hopefully that was a good overview. I'm happy to answer any questions that members might have.
Thank you, Ms. Graham, for that very thorough accounting of the bill. I certainly appreciate that. Very well done. Do we have any questions or comments from members for either the bill's author or for Ms. Graham? None. All right. I do not see any hands. So with that, Representative Mueller, I will turn it back to you for some final comments before we lay the bill over.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Ms. Graham for her the work that she does, not only explaining this bill to you, but all of the good work she does to get bills in shape and ready for committee and talking to the stakeholders. I've really enjoyed working with her, and this is a great bill and look forward to seeing it later on as we progress through the session. Thank you.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you to you both. And with that, with no further commentary, I am going to re-refer my motion to lay over House File 3471 as amended for future use in the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Bill. Lastly, we still have one more with Representative Mueller here. We have House File 3392. The bill here again is to lay this over for possible inclusion in our Human Services, Finance, and Policy Bill. Representative Mueller, I do not see any amendments on this one. So would you like to go ahead and proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I know that you all are very familiar with the good work that the Minnesota Council on Disability does, but just to give a little bit of overview here, the Minnesota Council on Disability represents and advocates for over a million Minnesotans. MCD is the only independent state agency that advocates for and represents all Minnesotans with disabilities. Disabilities affect everyone, whether you have a loved one with a disability, acquire a short-term disability, or if you live long enough, you will age into a disability. And disability is multifaceted. Of course, we hear about issues here in the Human Services Committee, but Minnesotans with disabilities are also impacted by underemployment, lack of adequate transportation options, public safety issues, adaptive education needs, inaccessible public and private spaces, lack of healthcare options, and more. So it really covers a wide range of the issues that we discuss at the legislature. MCD helps legislators ensure that their legislation serves and improves the lives of Minnesotans with disabilities. It not only serves as a disability watchdog, but also helps Minnesota businesses and organizations avoid potential violations of the ADA through training and technical assistance. With current budget and staffing levels, MCD often must choose between advising state government or public engagement, despite the statutory mandate to do both. And investing in MCD means investing in Minnesota's disability communities and in your constituents. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a number of testifiers here today who can explain the needs that this bill addresses.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. And I think first up we have Ms. Via Vincencio, if we have her available. Would you like to come before the committee, state your name, and proceed with your testimony?
Good morning, Chair.
There we are. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nikki Villavicencio, and I use she, hers pronouns. I'm a disabled Filipinx with brown hair and black glasses. I'm wearing a black sweater today, and I'm sitting on my kitchen floor. I live in Maplewood, and I'm the chair of the Minnesota Council on Disability. Today, I'm here to speak in support of House File 3392 to increase the appropriation for the Council on Disability. There are pivotal moments in our history when the council has been instrumental in creating and implementing change. When the Americans with Disabilities Act passed, MCD was a crucial part of implementing the state's ADA transition plan statewide. When the Help America Vote Act passed, MCD was a key partner in ensuring accessible voting in Minnesota. And throughout COVID-19, MCD has been an advocate for people with disabilities, has spoken truth to power, even when it is challenging, and in ensuring that people with disabilities are at the table. MCD convened a roundtable with advocates and physicians last year with state agency commissioners to assure that the state include disability as a priority group for COVID-19 vaccinations. And I am so thankful to our staff that participated in those COVID-19 conversations, ensuring once again that people with disabilities need to be included. I'm so very proud to be a small part of MCD. In 2020, I was appointed chair by the governor at the beginning of the pandemic. Much of our work was uncertain, and there was leadership changes. In the last 2 years, we have put in hard work and learned what good governance looks like. We are in a constant mode of adapting and improving, but it has been challenging with limited resources. Our staff is wearing several hats to meet the high demand for MCD services. However, without more staff to alleviate that increased workload, meet statutory requirements, and expand the capacity of MCD, the risk of staff burnout, loss of expert retention, and fewer disability policy resources is very high. Personally, I am worried about the progress of equity in the state of Minnesota without a fully staffed and resourced MCD. We are now at another transformational time in our country and our state. Where will we go from here? From workplace accommodations and hybrid environments to public health data collection on disabilities to ensuring people with disabilities are protected through civil rights, this is a changing point. Nearly every disability law, right, or protection requires someone with a disability to file a complaint or ask for an accommodation. Services and supports are not proactively given to people. Our council exists to help ensure equal opportunity. Our job as a council is to serve people with disabilities in Minnesota through policy, technical resources, and collaboration with stakeholders. As we say in the disability community, if you're not part of our community now, you will be someday. So thank you for listening to my testimony today, and please support the Council on Disability and support House File 3392. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Villavicencio. We do have next up, Mr. Dively?
Yes, thank
Dively,
you.
Dively, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Leading member and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Dively, and I'm the executive director here at the Minnesota Council on Disability. I'm a white male. I am in my 30s with a blurry background, wearing a gray tie, a gray suit, and a Puerto Rican flag lapel. I was raised in a deaf family, and sign language was my first language, and I have multiple disabilities. I began to lose my hearing when I became 30. In 1973, the state of Minnesota's legislature saw a need for people with disabilities to have an advocate, a seat at the policy-making table, and to ensure their rights are protected. So they created the Minnesota Council on Disability. We have made significant progress in implementation of the Americans with Disabilities Act in Minnesota, ensuring things like curb cuts and transportation is increasingly accessible, responding to emergencies, improving employment, although disability unemployment is still double the rate of others in Minnesota, instituting statewide IT accessibility standards, and our participation in literally dozens of committees and task forces to advance access. Next year will be our 50th anniversary as an agency, and the barriers and discrimination that people with disabilities experience are still here. We know that because we experience it and we hear it from people every single day. MCD serves all of your constituents, including Minnesotans with disabilities. The work we do benefits our government, law enforcement, counties and cities, nonprofits and businesses across the state by providing them guidance, technical advice on state and federal disability laws, and protects their liabilities while advancing the rights of people with disabilities. At different times over the years, our budget has been reduced. At one point, MCD had approximately 16 staff. Today, we have around 8 full-time equivalents. We have 9 enumerated duties and powers in our statute and dozens more statutory duties that touch nearly every part of a person's life and include most state agencies. In any week, we may work with 5 or more state agencies, the public, corporations, and nonprofit organizations, and we are proudly nonpartisan with bipartisan support in the legislative policies we advocate for, including this request in both the House and the Senate. Currently, each staff member wears multiple hats. We have one staff that handles interagency government relations for the entirety of state agencies, plus public policy work. We have one person to handle all technical assistance and disability access calls and email, and one person that does IT, facility standards, policy, HR, finance, reporting, communications, civic engagements, grants, and more. As a small agency, we are held to the same standards as larger cabinet agencies, despite fewer staff and resources. The pandemic showed that the Departments of Health, Human Services, Public Safety, with including Homeland Security, Emergency Management, and the Governor's Office, how important having a disability advisor is when coordinating access to healthcare and ensuring executive orders or regulations were inclusive of people with disabilities' needs. We'd redeployed voluntarily one of our few staff at our own expense to become part of the incident command structure at the State Emergency Operations Center. Unfortunately, that is not something we'd be able to continue to do in the future if there was another emergency. We need your investment to our agency so that we can fulfill the spirit and intent of our legislation, invest in professional development, establish and utilize a database tracking system to measure the impact that we make, ensure the services that the state offers are coordinated in meeting the needs of people, conducting programmatic reviews of those services, and bringing in subject matter experts in health, human services, employment, special education, public safety, and others that each have specific state and federal laws, regulations, and rules. And there's additional things that we have in mind as well, but for time considerations, I'll stay brief. In closing, we saw many of you at our public policy forum in January or at other public listening events that we've hosted. And you've heard the stories of barriers, discriminations, you've heard some today, and the need for increased advocacy directly from the people of Minnesota. Our community, your constituents, came to us and asked us to request an increase in funding, to increase our advocacy and advisement, to work to better the services in Minnesota, and to advance the rights and lives of people with disabilities in Minnesota. So we are here today asking for your investment into the Council on Disability, which is also an investment into your communities, to restore our funding and to grow our capacity. Thank you, Representative Mueller, for authoring this bill and to the committee for hearing our bill. And I ask you to support House File 3392, and I'll also stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dively. And our next testifier up today is Mr. Olson. Mr. Olson, if you'd like to go ahead and state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill and hearing my testimony today. My name is Cody Olson. I am a white male wearing glasses with brown hair and a brown beard and a blue button-up shirt. I have served as the Minnesota Council on Disabilities COVID-19 response lead throughout the duration of the pandemic and am MCD's policy advisor in the areas of public health, public safety, emergency management, and outdoor recreation access. Throughout the duration of the COVID-19 pandemic, I've been assigned to support a number of critical agency partners through our State Emergency Operations Center, including the Minnesota Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. In my role, I provide policy advice and technical expertise regarding disability inclusion and promoting health outcomes for Minnesotans with disabilities. I also work with MCD's communication staff and other state agency partners to ensure that our disability community is informed on public health guidance and receives timely, accurate, and accessible information. In my work, I also serve as a passionate community advocate, hearing stories from people with disabilities and empowering folks to share their experiences with state leaders and decision makers. It is because of the advocacy of the community throughout the pandemic that we have been able to make testing and vaccination efforts more accessible, revise and provide clear public health guidance that consider the needs of the disability community, and make the vaccine allocation process prioritize people with disabilities such as Down syndrome. Over the past 2 years, I have also supported other critical response efforts, including promoting disability inclusion in our response to civil unrest events, severe weather, and presently the Afghan refugee resettlement efforts. The council has spent decades building effective cross-agency partnerships, and our organization is well positioned to advance the interests and needs of Minnesotans with disabilities throughout our state. I urge the committee to support the extraordinary work of the Council on Disability, which promotes the rights and health of Minnesotans with disabilities. This budget proposal is critical in building capacity for our agency to meet the many and diverse needs of people with disabilities. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. And last testifier we have for today is Mr. Parker. Mr. Parker, are you available to go ahead and state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony? I think you're still on mute, Mr. Olson. Mr. Park.
Can you hear me?
There we go. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Parker. I am the legislative assistant to Senator Hoffman. I am speaking purely as a staffer on my behalf in support of MCD and their funding. Specifically, in the last 2 years, I've had the honor of working with them very closely on a couple key pieces of legislation. And I can say, as a staffer who works very heavily in the disability affairs field, that having an organization that is dedicated the way they are to the advocacy and connections is integral. Previously, before we were in a lot of activity and working as mostly legislative body and with other individual groups, it was far more challenging to organize and compare data in a way that they have brought to our office and many other offices. The way they have to communicate with such a variety of individuals, organizations, and agencies to gather feedback, input, develop policy, identify what's needed, and to bring forth and to collaborate together in that, I would call it invaluable. And I think it's a completely, not only a reasonable request, but an important one to expand their capacity. I think anyone at the legislature knows what it is to wear multiple hats. And when it comes to disability affairs particularly, it is often that their priorities fall to the side, and they need these champions, and they need as many champions as they can get to be able to adequately gather the information they need to be able to support people with disabilities that are always under stress, and to make sure that we are aware at the legislature, as communities, as agencies, of the multitude of troubles. I can't tell you how many times, particularly advocating just from our office, people are not aware of all the barriers that exist again and again, and that we have to be that educator, and having another, just having that dedicated resource to be those champions, again, invaluable. And so I just wanted to be here as a fellow staffer to support them in this and really highlight just how incredibly valuable I find them as an individual and working with the groups that we do. And thank you again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this. And try to keep it short and sweet. So thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. I'm sure it's a little unusual to be on this end of a hearing, for sure. So appreciate your testimony today. And with that, we have completed all of the testifiers that we had listed for today. Do we have any questions or comments from members for either the bill's author or for the testifiers? Again, must be great testimony. We have not had any issues with that. So if I don't see any comments or questions for any of the testifiers, then I will refer to the bill's author, Representative Moeller, to give some closing comments before we proceed with referring the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I should have also started off when I introduced the bill, describing myself as well. I'm a middle-aged white woman with dark blonde hair. I'm wearing glasses, a gray jacket, and I have a blurred background. I just want to thank all the testifiers. I'm going to start with Mr. Parker because it's very unusual to have someone from the other body coming over here to testify, and really appreciated the time he took to do that and explain the great work of the Minnesota Council on Disabilities. I also want to thank all of our other testifiers. I think you really laid out all of the great work you do and made the case for the need that you have with this appropriation. But I just want to personally thank you for the great work that you do and emphasize the importance of that. And finally, I just wanted to mention that this committee has heard testimony before about the changing demographics in our state. We also had the One Minnesota Conference where we heard about our demographics. We have an aging population in Minnesota. And I think that means two things. One, we have people with disabilities who are aging and may have more needs. And then we have people without disabilities who are aging and will age into disabilities. And so I think that the fact that our demographics are changing in that regard also means that this is the time to provide the appropriation that is needed to the Minnesota Council on Disabilities. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I really thank you for your support, and I look forward to seeing this bill later on. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moeller. And with that, I will go ahead and renew my motion to lay over House File 3392 to be included in the Human Services Policy and Finance Bill. We have no other business before us today, members, and in a ironic twist, we are done a little bit earlier than scheduled. We will pick up with our next scheduled meeting for next week. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you for being present today.